From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Harvey Fierstein wrote the screenplay for the new film Torch Song Trilogy, in which he reprises his Tony Award-winning Broadway performance. Coming up, Fierstein tells us about being gay in the still closeted world of entertainment. Also today, Amy Mann and Michael Hausman of the rock group Till Tuesday talk about the ways their music and their personal lives intersect. Rock historian Ed Ward explains how nostalgia gets in the way of serious rock scholarship. And book critic John Leonard has a review of the latest political novel from reporter-turned-novelist Ward Just. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Harvey Fierstein once described himself as the first real live, out-of-the-closet homosexual on Broadway. Fierstein is one of the few people who have crossed over from non-commercial gay theater to Broadway and Hollywood. Fierstein stars in the new film Torch Song Trilogy. He wrote the screenplay, which he adapted from his hit Broadway play. The show won him 2 Tonys for Best Actor and Best Play. In an article on the history of gay theater, Don Shuey wrote that it was surprising that the show that brought the gay theater and Broadway together, Torch Song, was about a drag queen, contained explicit references to anal sex, and a rousing conclusion in which a nice Jewish mother is told she can pack up her bunny slippers and go back to Miami if she can't accept her son's gay lifestyle. Shuey described Torch Song as a powerful, profoundly moving statement. In the new movie, Fierstein plays Arnold Beckoff, the gay man who performs nights in a drag show. Anne Bancroft plays his mother, and Matthew Broderick and Brian Kerwin co-star as his lovers. Fierstein also wrote the book for the hit Broadway musical La Cage aux Folles. Harvey Fierstein had to shop around his screenplay before New Line Pictures agreed to produce Torch Song Trilogy. I asked him if he thinks Hollywood is ready yet for films about gays.
I think if Torch Song makes money, they'll be more than ready.
I think
Hollywood's about making money, and, you know, anything that does it. If a movie about talking dogs makes money, you'll see 40 movies about talking dogs. If a movie about gay people as human beings makes money, I think you'll see lots of those.
Did you get a lot of suggestions for toning down the screenplay or deleting scenes?
No, well, I mean, from New Line, you mean, or from
other people?
Yeah, from other people. I mean, they felt that there should be a really big star in the role of Arnold.
That must have made you real happy.
Well, I said, fine. You know, I said, absolutely fine. There's lots of big stars that are gay. Let one of them come out and play it.
Mm-hmm.
And but, of course, that's asking the impossible. So the only people that were even talked about were heterosexuals. You know, there's a thing in Hollywood. Thousands of gay people every day play heterosexual. Nobody ever says a word about it. As soon as a heterosexual plays a gay, oh, they throw all kinds of awards at them and say how brave they are and all that. And I didn't want Torch Song to be part of that.
Uh-huh.
Torch Song meant too much to me and too much to the gay community and to too many people that just appreciate honesty. And I didn't want Torch Song just being something else where a heterosexual comes along and puts a little eyeshadow on and says, oh, I'm gay.
Torch Song was written by you before AIDS, and it's set in the 1970s. Did you find that some people wanted you to preach or moralize about safe sex, even though it was set before AIDS?
No, absolutely. Nobody wanted me to talk about safe sex.
Uh-huh.
I mean, people did ask, you know, how I would treat it. I just think that people have to keep in mind that a very tiny percent of gay people have AIDS. The media has done a horrible, disgusting, lying job on the American public of trying to say homosexuality equals AIDS and vice versa. And that is a lie, and it is an ugly, vicious lie. But I felt that it was really important, especially now that gay people get to see themselves as something other than a high-risk group. We are human beings. AIDS is only a virus. It is not part of us. It is a disease that did get into the gay community and get passed around. But if you look at any of the figures, you can see that the gay community now has taken responsibility. And the new cases are not among gay people. They're among heterosexuals. And I was not going to allow my work to be used to continue this lie.
My guest is Harvey Fierstein, who wrote the screenplay and stars in the new film Torch Song Trilogy, which is based on his hit Broadway show. You're really one of the few out-of-the-closet actors or writers on Broadway or Hollywood, which is really ironic because we all know that there's a lot of gays in the entertainment business. Has that been strange for you, knowing that a lot of people are gay, but that they can't really come out?
Well, they can come out. It's what's hard for me is remembering that I can't talk about them.
Right. Well,
because
that's right.
Their choice.
Exactly.
Because their choice is to lie about their lives. I can't. You know, like when somebody says, "Well, who is gay in Hollywood?" You know, it's almost like saying, "Go ahead, Harvey, name names or something."
Yeah.
And that puts me in a very very strange position. Because I can't, and it puts them in a strange position because they have to live their life as a lie. I don't know how they do it. I really don't.
Well, you know, you were talking about how you didn't want a heterosexual to do this big stretch and play a gay man, you know, starring in Torch Song. On the other hand, I could think of probably a lot of gay actors who might have been reluctant to take on such a role because they might have feared that it would get them out of the closet.
Yeah.
You know, a heterosexual can always bring their celebrity girlfriend to a big party and say, "No, I'm not gay, I was just acting." But if you really are gay and you don't want to come out, it might be a problem to play a gay role. Had you run across that kind of thing?
Yeah, of course. That's only natural. I mean, if you're going to lie, then you want to play things as opposite you as you can.
Is it difficult to cast heterosexuals in gay roles? I mean, Matthew Broderick, for instance, who plays one of your characters' lovers in Torch Song Trilogy, is heterosexual. Or at least I'm assuming that he is.
Well, I think you just hit
right.
One of the things right on the head,
which is
that the world basically assumes that everyone's heterosexual.
Well, I've been reading so much about his relationship with Jennifer Grey that you know, but
don't talk about that stuff.
All right. Well, no. But here's what I wanted to know, though, that
leave my baby's life alone. Remember, you're not only talking about my lover, you're talking about my son.
That's right, from Broadway.
Right, of course. Right. I gave Matthew his first job, and he played my son in Torch Song.
Right.
And we've been friends for all these years, and now we had a switch to play lovers. But
as soon as
the movie was over, yeah, he went right back to being my son. So, you know, I have a mother's protectiveness. So don't talk about my son.
Let's leave him out of it. But, I mean, I would imagine that you'd want some kind of, like, assurance beforehand that if a heterosexual actor is playing the role of a gay man, that they're not going to be uncomfortable with it.
Well, yeah. I mean, I had that assurance, obviously, because Matthew had played my gay son.
Right.
I mean, he didn't just play my son, he played my gay son. And I knew Matthew wasn't uptight about it at all. Brian Kerwin, who plays my other lover in the movie, had done Torch Song, and I knew he wasn't uptight at all. In fact, Brian was the most unuptight of anybody. I mean, he made me look uptight because Brian wasn't scared. Brian is, when somebody's really sure of their own sexuality and they have a confidence in their own life, they can do anything. That's one of the problems of gay actors who won't admit that they're gay. It limits them incredibly because, you know, you can't be somebody else if you don't even know who you are.
Mm-hmm.
But Brian does, and so Brian wasn't uptight at all about playing the role.
Harvey Fierstein is my guest, and he wrote the screenplay and stars in the new film Torch Song Trilogy.
A fabulous movie.
Now, you were really virtually never in the closet, as far as I know. I think you came out when you were 13.
Yeah, I was always too fat to stay in the closet. It's very crowded in there. I once had, you know, I'll tell you a closet joke.
Okay.
A New York columnist, rather... bitchy one, named Cindy Adams, was doing a piece on my apartment, which had just been decorated, you know, doing one of those at-home pieces. And all she wanted to do was open my closet doors and find dresses. And I said, "Why would I have dresses in the closet?" She said, "Well, you play it, drag queen, on stage." And I said, "But I play it on stage." And anyway, she was not satisfied until she went through every single one of my closets and found no dresses. Another time, Mayor Koch came to see me in Torch Song, and so he wanted to come backstage and say hello afterwards. So the secret police come into the dress room, you know, to make sure there are no bombs or murderers or whatever. So they look around the dress room, and then they said, do you mind if we search your closet? I said, honey, if you have to look in my closet, you haven't seen the show. My closets are empty.
How did you tell your parents when you came out?
I didn't. I didn't have to.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they knew I knew. Everybody knew. I mean, it was, obviously there was a time when we put a name to it. But before that, everybody sort of knew. As my brother once said in an interview, Harvey was just always Harvey, and we just sort of accepted Harvey as Harvey. And I mean, I was brought up, what I like to think correctly, in being taught that self-respect was everything.
Anne Bancroft plays your mother in the film version of Torch Song, and I want to play a clip from the movie. In which,
isn't this radio?
Yeah, we're just going to hear it. We're not going to see it.
Oh, okay.
So this is a scene after your lover has been beaten on the streets by homophobes.
Not beaten, murdered.
Murdered, yeah, beaten to death. The mother comes, and she's recently lost her husband, your father in the movie.
Right.
And she's still suffering her loss, but can't comprehend your loss. It seems kind of insignificant to her that, you know, a lover who you didn't know all that long, and also you've just told her, you know, she you had withheld the information from her in the movie. And so she's just recently found out. So here's a kind of argument between the mother, played by Anne Bancroft, and the man, played by you.
If I had ever opened a mouth to my mother the way you did to me, you'd be talking to a woman with a size 6 wedgie sticking out of her forehead. But I didn't raise my children like that. I wanted my children to respect me because they wanted to, not because I beat it into them. Go, no.
You're gonna start this all over again now.
Yes! Because it's not fair to put all the blame on me. You think I didn't know about you, Arnold? Believe me, I knew. I knew. But I said no. I hoped. What's the difference? I knew when I turned my back. I wasn't the only one. You turned your back on me, too. You opened a mouth to me about your friend Alan. How was I supposed to know?
All of a sudden, you would have understood.
Maybe. You don't know. You never trusted me enough to tell me. You never said a word.
So you could have said what? He's better off dead, right?
Maybe I could have comforted you. Maybe I could have told you what to expect. You cheated me out of your life and then blamed me for not being there.
That's a scene that you wrote for you and Anne Bancroft.
Right.
Were there scenes like that at all in your family? Is that,
no, because see, the problem between Arnold and his mother is that, and she puts it quite well, even if I had to write it myself, she puts it quite well in that scene, which is Arnold always talked about his sex life. She says earlier, you shoved your sex life down my throat every hour on the hour like aspirin. But he never, ever said that he loved the guy. And she always saw Arnold as somebody who was homosexual, meaning that he had sex with guys, but never stopped to realize that he possibly had an emotional life with these people. And what she says in that scene is, you cut me out of your life. You never told me. You cut me out of your life, then you blame me for not being there. And that has to do with honesty. It's not enough to be partially honest. I think you either share your life with somebody or you don't. It's not enough to say, I have sex with guys. You have to discuss that you actually love somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she's very correct. And no, I didn't have those scenes because I discuss my emotional life with my mother. I discuss my emotional life with my brother. We have a very close family. We discuss everything. So no, we don't have those kind of problems. I think those are the kind of problems you have when you don't really accept yourself.
Now, you grew up in Bensonhurst, which is in Brooklyn, New York. It was, at least then, when you were growing up, I think, a predominantly Jewish, middle-class neighborhood of
Italian, well, yeah.
Jewish and Italian. Italian, okay. And of mostly middle-class families.
Yeah.
Middle-class and working-class families. Did you know any gays when you were growing up? How did you find, like, a gay community, other gay people? I don't know.
I went to Manhattan like most
right,
people
right.
do.
exactly.
The joke, of course, uh-huh. is that several of my friends, my childhood friends, who I lost touch with over the years, mm-hmm. all of a sudden I've found again, were also gay.
And you didn't know?
No, of course. I mean, we were prepubescent.
Yeah.
Such things weren't talked about. You know, as kids do, we called each other fag. and had no idea we all really were. So, you know, I remember I went through a point where I was like telling my mother, oh, I ran into this one, I ran into that one, you know, he's gay, she's gay. And my mother said, what was it with you? I said, I don't know, maybe it was the water. Maybe it was something in the water there in Bensonhurst. I don't know. But, yeah, I mean, there are gay people everywhere. It's just that you have to go looking for a community because we're so invisible.
How did you start doing drag shows?
It was totally by mistake, like most of life. There are, well, actually, there's no such thing as a mistake. There are only accidents. And I auditioned for Andy Warhol, who was doing his one and only play called Pork. And I got it, and they put me in a dress, and away I went. Kind of simple.
Did you do drag shows in a character similar to the character you do in Torch Song? And you do a personality called Virginia Ham.
Yeah. I tried it, but I really wasn't very good at it. I'm sort of not a good cabaret performer. I need an audience pointed right at me with no sharp instruments in their hands, like, you know, knives and forks, and certainly no booze in them. So I wasn't very good in cabaret. I was much better in theater, so that's where I went.
What kind of numbers did you do in the cabaret?
Bad ones. I did do Victoria de Los Angeles singing Sempre Libra. That was sort of my highlight. Yeah, I was just terrible. You want me to say it, I'll say it. I stunk. I was awful. I hate it. It was terrible.
That's what I was looking for.
You know you're bad. You know you're bad when after the third time you've done your show, every time you get up to a punchline, the bartender screams it out from the back of the room. You know you're bombing bad.
Did you want to be good? Did you want to do a drag show? I mean, did that fulfill an ambition of yours, or did you just kind of fall into it?
I sort of fell into it. Somebody wanted to produce me in a drag show. I had a friend of mine who was a cabaret performer, a woman, and she wanted to do a show. And we sort of looked for a gimmick, and the gimmick was this show that we put together called Sisters. And she was great, and I was terrible, but they didn't want to see her because she was a real woman. And they didn't want to see me because I was awful. So life went on, you know. It was that certain summer, you know. Mm. And after that, life went on. And I was able, of course, to use my experiences there to create the drag show that's in the movie.
Well, I want to talk with you more about the movie and about your life, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Harvey Fierstein, who wrote the screenplay for Torch Song Trilogy, and he stars in it as well. It's based on his play of the same name. And he's also done several other plays. He wrote the book for La Cage aux Folles on Broadway. He wrote Safe Sex and Legs Diamond, which just opened on Broadway. We'll be back. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Harvey Fierstein is my guest. Something I meant to ask you earlier, but I want to get back to. Your character in the movie, who is a professional drag queen, he performs at night in a drag club, says at some point that he's afraid that gays will at some point do with drag queens what blacks did with
Aunt Jemima.
With Aunt Jemima and Amos and Andy, sweep them under the rug.
Right.
And I'd like you to elaborate on that.
Well, for years there have been battles over the gay pride day parades, you know, to not let drag queens march in the parade or not let people in leather march in the parade, you know, that we should be presenting this sort of nice look to the public. Because, of course, the joke is that the media goes in and you can have 500,000 people dressed like everyday people in a parade. That's not who they're going to show on the news. They're going to show the three drag queens that are there. And there's always this big discussion. Do we tell them not to come? Do we make the media not cover them? And in the long run, what has to be done is that we have to accept all of us. We have to accept all of our community. We can't just say only people dressed like regular people allowed. But there is a great prejudice among many gay people against the more flamboyant gay people.
Did you ever run into that personally?
Yeah, Sure. I mean, I've never done drag in the street, so I haven't run up against it that way. But I certainly have been in discussions where they say, well, I had somebody call me and said they wanted to come to the New York premiere, but they wanted to come in full drag. Would I be insulted? And I said, not if you're going to have a good time doing it. You have a good time. I mean, that person isn't hurting anybody. You can laugh at that person, you know, say that person looks ridiculous or that person looks beautiful, or, but that person's having a good time. They're not hurting anybody. And I think, you know, I accept myself. I therefore can accept other people as long as they ain't hurting nobody.
We were talking earlier about gays playing heterosexuals and heterosexuals playing gays. As an actor, are you open to playing gay or straight?
Yeah, I would like to be. It's just the roles that I've been offered. Most of the straight roles are just too boring. You know, one thing that I've learned in this age of AIDS is that life is very short, and that you don't waste your time doing bull. And, you know, so I turn down anything that I think is boring. I want to enjoy my life while I'm here. So, and most roles that get offered to me that are straight, usually what happens is the writer hasn't written a role and they need somebody to fill it in. They say, oh, good, Harvey, he has a personality. Go get Harvey, he'll fill it in. And I don't want to do that. If I work in somebody else's thing, I want them to have done the kind of work that I would do if they were going to act in my thing.
Outside of the Warhol show that you mentioned, have you acted in other people's shows?
Oh, yeah, I did. Before Tort Song, I had done about 60 original plays. So, yeah, and I had a lot of writers that wrote for me. But they were either gay roles, drag roles, or women's roles. Women's roles to be played by a man. So they were kind of interesting. I mean, I played prostitutes and all kinds of fun things.
You've been, I think, you know, pretty active in working on behalf of more research for AIDS and raising consciousness about AIDS. Is it ever difficult for you to divide your time between work you want to do related to AIDS and work you want to do for you know, in movies or theater?
Yeah, it's always hard. You know, you've got when you have several careers going and a consciousness as well.
Yeah.
It, of course, it tears at your time, but I'm happily selfish enough to make sure that I get my time alone. I live a very, very quiet and solitary life in the country where I spend most of my time. I live on top of a hill with two dogs and have my time to recuperate there. And then I come down to the city and do a blitz. Like today, you know, I'm doing 6 interviews back to back. But then I'll take the next 2 days off. So, you know, you just have to find a balance. And the worst, because the worst thing that can happen to somebody who is a celebrity is to be out there so much that they start not liking it. And you have to like what you do. Like I said, life's too short to do things you don't like doing.
I'm so surprised to hear that you live in the country. You've always seemed like such an urban person.
Well, I am. But, you know, things change. I mean, I moved up to the country just thinking it would be for weekends or during the summer or something, and found that I liked it. Mm-hmm. It's a lot easier to write in the quiet. And I like being judged as just a good neighbor. You know, up in the country, everybody in town knows me as Harvey who pays his bills. And Harvey who's always nice, you know. And here in the city, it's you're judged at, you know, what level of celebrity you're at.
Uh-huh. In the movie, the character that you play is a character that really wants to create a family, to have a long-term monogamous relationship. He adopts a son, a teenage son. And I was wondering if that was an ambition of yours, if you'd ever considered, you know, adopting
a kid. Arnold, the character that in the movie, is somebody who chooses a life that's not unlike what some people would think of as a heterosexual life.
Mm-hmm.
But as I always say, family and commitment and love and raising children are not heterosexual things, they're human things. Arnold chooses that lifestyle, which is not necessarily for every gay person or not necessarily for every straight person. No, I would not at this point in my life want to adopt, because I'd want to give a lot of attention and love to anyone that I adopted, and my life is too scattered with appearances and projects and all that to do that. So not right now. Would I ever? Yeah, someday I would like to.
Harvey, can I ask you about your voice? It's
what about my voice?
Oh, that it's
what about my voice?
It's very deep and kind of raspy, and I was wondering if your voice had always been like that, or if it's
well, it was at 9 this morning.
Uh-huh.
Call me about 4. I'll tell you if it's still like that. Yes, it's always been like this.
What kinds of books or movies or shows were you able to see or read that you felt portrayed the life you knew or the people you knew or yourself in some way that you could really identify with?
Well, not many gay ones. I mean, whatever gay pieces there were did not reflect my life at mm-hmm. all, but I was thrilled to see a gay person. Just glad to know that somebody admitted we existed. I mean, there were films when I was growing up like Sunday Bloody Sunday, Boys in the Band, Staircase, The Gay Deceivers. They were either camp or tragedy, with nothing like a normal life ever shown. And certainly nobody ever loved normally in those films. And so that's what I needed. I remember the great hoopla. I guess I was in my first year of high school when a film called The Fox came out, and there was all this hoopla that there was, you know, sort of this lesbian relationship in it. And Killing of Sister George was another one. And I, you know, as a gay teenager, ran to all of them trying to find a little piece of myself. Unfortunately, most times I found more of myself in old Cary Grant pictures. I mean, at least they had something to do with my life.
Mm-hmm. What?
They were human beings.
Uh-huh.
They were just seen as human beings. You know, not as something sensationalistic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let me ask you, you know, a lot of celebrities, which you are becoming or have become already, are very guarded about talking about their personal life, or at least they pretend to be. And some people, no matter how much they want press, they want to at least maintain the image of privacy. You're, I think, pretty open about your life. And I was wondering if you felt almost like a responsibility to do that in consciousness-raising terms.
I guess I made a decision that I would sacrifice that part of my life. I mean, obviously, I don't tell the truth about everything in my life.
Right.
But I made a decision to sacrifice that kind of privacy so that people will see a gay person having the everyday problems that straight people have, to realize that we all do have exactly the same problems. So I have, with my lover's permission, been public about our life together. Just they see us as a couple.
Mm-hmm.
At the Hollywood opening of Torch Song, my lover and I were walking, holding hands, and the press asked us, you know, to separate as nicely as they could so they could get pictures of me not holding this man's hand. So I said, fine, and I put my hand into Brian Kerwin's hand, and we walked hand in hand instead. So when they cropped the picture, they just cut our hands out.
Really?
To publish the picture, yeah.
Well, why? I mean, you're out. I mean, what?
Because the press still doesn't realize that I'm happy. Still doesn't realize that I actually accept being gay, that Brian is not upset about being a straight person holding a man's hand. I mean, that, like I said, my feeling is the American public is a loving, beautiful public. It is the media that think they have to protect the American public from human beings.
And I should just mention here that the Brian you're referring to, Brian Kerwin, stars in the movie of Torch Song Trilogy.
Yes, he plays
your lover in it. Well, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your time with us today. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Now tell him how much you love the movie.
Thanks for doing the interview.
Bye-bye.
And Harvey Fierstein stars in the new film Torch Song Trilogy. He also wrote the screenplay. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time I'll speak with photographer Dwayne Michaels, and he suggests the interior landscape rather than recording the social landscape with his photographs. His new book is a series of portraits. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Amy Mann and Michael Houseman have had their ups and downs in their personal relationships, and often those trials and tribulations have become the subject for songs by their rock group Till Tuesday. Coming up, Amy Mann and Michael Houseman talk about laying their private lives in the public eye. Also, rock historian Ed Ward has some year-end thoughts on the future of rock and roll's past. And book critic John Leonard reviews Jack Gantz, the latest political novel from reporter-turned-novelist Ward Just. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. The U.S. has announced that starting January 1st, it will impose steep tariffs on $100 million worth of food exports from the European Community. NPR's Barbara Mantell reports.
The U.S. is retaliating for a European Community ban on imports of hormone-treated meat, some of which comes from the United States. That European ban is due to take effect on the first of the year. The U.S. Trade Representative's office says it will impose 100% import duties on European Community canned tomatoes, tomato sauce, wine coolers, instant coffee, boneless beef, fruit juices, some pork products, and pet food. European officials say their ban on imports of hormone-treated meat is a response to pressures from consumer groups concerned about the possible health risks posed by the hormones. U.S. officials say, however, that the European ban is a trade barrier in disguise and that the European Community has yet to present any evidence that the proper application of growth hormones poses any threat to consumers of the meat. The European hormone ban and U.S. retaliation could be just the first blows in a trade dispute. The U.S. has threatened to ban all imports of European Community meat if the hormone ban is not modified. I'm Barbara Mantell in New York.
In Lockerbie, Scotland, the bodies of five Americans were placed in simple pine coffins today for the trip to the U.S. They are the first bodies to be released from last week's crash of Pan Am Flight 103. Meanwhile, explosives experts began laboratory tests on a suitcase and pieces of the wreckage of the flight. It's hoped the analysts will determine whether the 747 went down because of a bomb blast on board. An Eastern Airlines 727 that made a forced landing yesterday when a hole developed in its fuselage had a history of unscheduled landings, and federal inspectors found a crack in the jet's fuselage 2 years ago. The plane landed safely in Charleston, West Virginia, after a 14-inch gash near the tail section caused the cabin to decompress. It was the jet's eighth unscheduled landing in 5 years. Two National Transportation Safety Board officials plan to send the metal flap that peeled off the fuselage to the agency's Washington lab for testing. The agency says it appears that the area of the fuselage containing the tear is newer than the aircraft. A U.S. magistrate in Tampa, Florida, today ordered that a 60-year-old Turkish national be sent to Savannah, Georgia, to face espionage charges. It's the latest development in a case involving an Army warrant officer arrested in Georgia last week. Michael Fechter of member station WUSF has details.
The FBI claims Hussein Yildirim served as the middleman for a U.S. Army warrant officer selling information on electronic spying efforts in Europe to the East Germans. Yildirim lived in Germany when warrant officer James Hall III was stationed there. Hall interpreted, intercepted military communications and had top secret clearance. He's charged with giving the information to Yildirim, who exchanged it with the East Germans for an undisclosed amount of money. A search of Yildirim's home last week turned up a photograph of Hall and a $30,000 deposit slip from a German bank account and records corroborating phone calls and visits to Savannah, Georgia, where Hall was reassigned. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Fechter in Tampa.
A front-page editorial in the Chinese People's Daily newspaper calls on the government to impose new austerity measures to help fight the country's economic problems. The commentary is the latest piece in the official media to focus on the seriousness of the economic crisis, which has seen inflation soar to 26% and industrial growth shoot up to an unsustainable level of almost 20%. Although incomes as a whole are rising, surveys have shown that up to 20% of urban residents report that their living standards are declining as a result of the rise in retail prices. Stock prices were lower in light trading on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 6 points to close at 2162.68. Declines led advances 7-4 on volume of 88 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange lost 10 cents. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Every week on this show, rock historian Ed Ward profiles a band or an artist that has somehow influenced the course of rock and roll. Artists that many of us missed when they were first becoming known or who were performing before some of us were born. It's an understatement to say that the history of rock and roll is important to Ed, and there are certain trends in the retelling of this history that have him worried.
As we leave another year behind, I thought it would be appropriate to think about the future of rock and roll's past. What got me thinking about this was a letter I got from a listener. "Dear Mr. Ward," it said, "I listen to you on NPR and would like to ask you for some assistance. I work with young children who think that Michael Jackson was the first great rock star. These children were shocked to find out that Paul McCartney was in a band before Wings. My nephew is 5 years old. I would like to introduce him to the great rock and roll bands that have come before Wham and Michael Jackson. I want to make an audio cassette tape of classic rock hits. Do you have any suggestions for songs that will help my nephew on his way to a good appreciation of rock and roll music?" It was signed by Kathy Look in Gurnee, Illinois. Here's what I wrote back. "Dear Miss Look, you're probably going to hate me for telling you this, but about the worst thing you can do is to try to introduce youngsters to rock and roll. Really, trust me. Rock and roll is part of growing up. It's something you discover that your parents hate. If you're very lucky, your nephew will be a teenager in a time when there's something so yucky it'll drive his parents nuts. But make sure that kids have access to the classics, because there comes the day when they decide they need them. Make sure that you don't have a censorious attitude toward what they consider classic. The more they hear, the more they'll understand. Make sure they have access to good books on the subject and movies and videos, from Alan Freed and Mr. Rock and Roll to the remarkable footage of Prince's last tour. They'll find what they need, and they'll think it's cool if it doesn't smell too much like an adult. Both Wham and Michael Jackson are in the great rock and pop tradition, and if the kids you work with are into them, great. It doesn't take much for the smart ones to see how Michael connects with James Brown, and before him, Louis Jordan and Bill Robinson and Louis Armstrong. And Wham comes from the same British showbiz tradition that gave us a lot of the British invasion groups, and before that, the music hall. In sum, Miss Look, as The Who said, the kids are all right. They'll take care of this themselves if you silently provide the backup." Sometimes I feel I gotta get away. Bells chime, I know I gotta get away. And I know if I don't, I go out of my mind. But after I sent the letter, something else occurred to me. Yeah, the kids are all right, but they're really only as good as the information they're able to get. It's bad enough that there's a huge movement to turn back the clock and pretend that the awesome amount of teenage autonomy that's been built up since the 50s can just be turned off. It's horrifying to consider that it's now an accepted thing to put warning labels on records and declare certain types of concerts, most notably rap and heavy metal, off limits to teenagers. If rock and roll is to have a future, these trends have to be fought by those of us who grew up in a world where they weren't even chilling possibilities. What worries me, though, is something that's just as insidious because it's hardly getting any attention: the rewriting of the rock and roll past. The classic example is Albert Goldman, a contemptible figure who, it seems, will stop at nothing to reshape the past to his own mean vision of it. As critic Grill Marcus noted in a speech reprinted in last month's Harper's Magazine, Goldman, in his book on Elvis, twisted the remark that Sam Phillips of Sun Records once made. "If I could find a white boy with the Negro sound and the Negro feel," he told his secretary, Marion Kiesker, "I could make $1 billion. But Goldman found the quote unacceptable. He changed it to, "If I could find a white boy who could sing like a nigger, I'd make $1 billion. Now, those of us who have studied rock and roll's history know that Sam Phillips built his business on working with black people, and those of us who have met him know that he's a deeply religious man to whom brotherhood is central. He would never have uttered the words Goldman imputed to him. But Goldman is who is believed. Marcus said that when he wrote a publisher who was quoting Goldman, misquoting Phillips, the publisher wrote him back and told him he was certain Goldman was correct because it was more vulgar. And when you're dealing with this sort of music, he wrote, vulgarity is always closer to the truth. What defense does Kathy Look's little nephew have against such scurrilous, insidious, and demeaning misinformation? The only defense is access to writers who tell the truth, none of whom have a fraction of the academic credentials or promotion budgets of the Albert Goldmans of the world. Read the pieces on Sam Phillips and Peter Guralnick's books, Feel Like Going Home and Lost Highway, and you'll never believe Goldman. The trouble is, both those books are out of print at the moment. And it's only because Guralnick's last book, Sweet Soul Music, got such good reviews that Harper & Row is putting them back into print this spring. And even that won't do the kid any good if all the public library has is Goldman's book, or no books on rock and roll at all, which, thanks to some fanatics who are currently on a campaign to borrow and lose library books they don't agree with, is a distinct possibility. And how will he even know what he's looking for if the older music he's exposed to is also censored by so-called oldies stations that don't play any non-Motown black music? Or if he grows up on sold-on-TV anthologies that falsify the true history of the 60s by leaving out the artistically and politically controversial stuff? Or if, by the time he's curious, record stores have stopped carrying artifacts of the music's past in order to maximize present profits? Just as it's up to those who make, manufacture, and write about music these days to see to it that the censors don't shut down rock and roll's present, it's up to those of us who write and care about its past to see to it that that past is brought into the future intact.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Amy Mann and her Boston-based rock group Till Tuesday scored a hit in 1985 with the title track from their debut album Voices Carry. Mann formed the group in 1982 and continues to be the group's songwriter, bassist, and lead singer. Till Tuesday has a new album, their third, called Everything's Different Now. Many of the songs are about relationships gone sour. In fact, several songs seem to be about Mann's breakup with singer-songwriter Jules Shear. Rock critic Ken Tucker said the album could have been an embarrassing exposé, but instead it's an understated triumph with a pleasing balance between life and art. This is Amy Mann's song, J for Jules.
I was saying my prayers. He was coming. That began with a J for Jules. You know I miss you, and that's it.
Mann told me that while her songs are basically autobiographical, she usually adds fictional elements. I asked her why.
Well, because what you're going for is the realness of emotion, the realness of the situation. And a lot of times, in order to impart the emotion more accurately, you have to make up a few details because relationships and, you know, with anybody are too complex to be able to tell every detail and assume that that's going to be understood. You know, so a lot of times you have to sort of boil it down or substitute, you know, or tell about it metaphorically.
Are there occupational hazards when two songwriters are romantically involved and live together? Did you used to wonder if your songs were about the other, you know?
Oh, no, because they were. You didn't have to wonder about it. I mean, you know, mine are obviously that, and, well, I mean, the ones that appear to be usually are. And his were quite often about me, but, I mean, he never admits to having anything have a counterpart in real life. But I knew it nevertheless. My boyfriend now writes songs that are 1,000 times more autobiographical and accurate and incisive. And, you know, I mean, he's much more no holds barred. But that's okay, because he's really honest with me, and that's, you know, that's what counts. Well, it's not like some dirty, horrible secret's going to come out in a song. It's all stuff we've talked about before.
Yeah, talked about before. I guess I'm curious if there's a code of ethics that you follow when you're writing a song about someone. Do you let them know before the song comes out? A song like J for Jules, now that's really obviously about Jules. Do you let someone know if a song's clearly about them?
Well, if you mean, did he
let them know before the public hears it? Yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, he heard, I think he heard like rough mixes or something. I'm not really sure. I can't remember. But I'm pretty, yeah, I mean, he heard the album before it was released. But, you know, I mean, he's not really in a situation to wherein he can protest that much about it. And I think probably the mention of his name made him feel a little odd, but that was as much as he would say. You know, he didn't say, you're going to release this over my dead body. It's not like I'm saying bad stuff about him anyway.
That's right.
And also, I think he's just primarily concerned with whether it's a good song or not.
You seem to have a gift for songs about heartbreak. Do you find it easier to write songs about relationships ending?
No, but I just haven't really been given the chance to to write songs about, you know, good relationships. I mean, I've written some, but, you know, most people don't find themselves in that many good relationships. There's always some problem. And, you know, problem solving is what I'm trying to do when I write a song.
There have been so many both good and bad love songs and heartbreak songs written over the decades that I imagine it would be very, very difficult to find not only something new to say, but new words to say it with, words that don't sound like song cliches.
Well, the way to do that is to write quite honestly about what you feel and what you feel happened to you and you know, what you want and what you want to happen, you know, because everybody's experience is unique to themselves, and that's where the uniqueness of the voice will come from if you're able to use your own voice naturally and honestly. And I mean, you know, honesty is something that you don't have to learn, that you just have to relax and let take over.
Tell the truth, it wasn't bad. We had to have a reason, and lack of love wasn't it. We both know we had a past, but present must contain a future where both of us can fit.
Introduce Michael Hausman, one of the original members of Till Tuesday, who's with you. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Michael, you play drums, percussion, and now do programming
right.
as well. I was wondering if as a drummer you ever, if you feel like your role as a drummer has been changed by electronics, by the presence of synthesizers.
Oh, yeah. It changes your life in a lot of different ways. I mean, for one thing, if when you're talking about songwriting, it's very easy now for songwriters to, with a small drum machine, compose and sort of script out what they want to hear from the drummer. And that's a little frustrating because this, you know, one of the things that I was always really interested in was to be involved in the early stages of songwriting so that I could influence the feel of the song, the tempo, the meter, the form, those sort of things.
It's not that I'm frightened of being alone, just that I know what a burden this grief can be. Everything happens to something I know. Can't understand for the moment what this could.
Michael, I have a question for you. Amy and I were talking before about writing songs about lovers. And I know when Until Tuesday was started, you and Amy were both romantically involved.
Right.
And then you broke up, but the band stayed together. You both stayed together as performers.
Right.
So you were in the position probably of playing on songs that were in some way about you, about the relationship, the romantic relationship you used to have. What's that like?
As far as songs being about my relationship or our relationship, I think that at that time, a lot of it, that's sort of before the first album, and a lot of those songs were about relationships, but they weren't really that specific. So I couldn't say, this is obviously about us, although I know that a lot of the feelings that Amy was having, she was venting, you know, in these songs. I think that what was worse was playing on songs that weren't about me.
Yeah. No, Michael was not one of those people who gave me a hard time. I gave him a hard time. And I didn't write so much about that aspect of it. I didn't write about my own shortcomings on the other
people's. Thanks both very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Amy Mann and Michael Hausman of the group Till Tuesday. Their new album, Everything's Different Now, is on Epic Records. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us with a preview of what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, I gather one of the things we're going to learn tonight is why European pet food is about to cost twice as much in the States.
That's right, and Danish hams and some alcoholic beverages. It's because the U.S. is slapping 100% duties on certain European products. It's retaliation for what the United States calls a restrictive trade practice. So the Europeans who are going to start keeping out American meat because they say it's produced with growth hormones. We'll hear why the Europeans are doing that and what the United States is doing about it. Also, we have a special report by Nina Totenberg on the case of a Texas man convicted of rape and murder who was mentally retarded. And the question is, should the state of Texas be permitted to execute him despite his having a mental age of 7?
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. For years, Ward Just was a celebrated national and international correspondent for The Washington Post. He retired from reporting to write fiction. His insights into the Washington power scene have made their way into his latest novel, Jack Gantz. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Ward Just no longer bothers to mention on the jackets of his novels that he used to be a newspaper man. Since 1970, quietly, without ever raising his voice, in books like The Congressman Who Loved Flaubert and A Family Trust, Just has become an important novelist, a national resource. I can't think of another writer of his quality who has made it his artistic business to imagine the whys and wherefores of morality in politics, the way Washington works, how the men and women who play with our power buttons came to be there, why they choose as they do among the ambiguities, what they see in the unkindly mirror. Without the glittering contempt of, say, a Gore Vidal, or the boom-boom and hugger-mugger of the Alan Drurys and Fletcher Knebels, or the swamp fevers of the conspiracy theorists, It's as if the best of Louis Auchincloss had gone to our nation's capital and turned into somebody very much like Stendhal. Jack Gantz is the story of a young man who grows up from the machine politics of Chicago to the United States Senate. It is not the whole story, because Just specializes in the suggestive, in a telescoping of entire decades into a page or two of pattern, in dreamlike narrative ellipses, before pulling the reader up short and making us sit through confrontations and revelations from which most writers would duck and run. What we get is what Jack himself thinks is important. What we are asked to imagine is everything he avoids or denies about himself. Thus we watch his father go to prison for tax evasion. We follow him to the University of Chicago. We see him taken under Mayor Daley's wing as a pollster in the Kennedy campaign for the presidency in 1960. We get through his affair with Carol, which itself is quiet. Quote, "When we had finished making love, the term is too demure for the disorder of those afternoons, we would drink beer together, one beer, sharing the can, and then she would leave." And we go with him to JFK's Washington in 1961 and stay there until Jimmy Carter. Just listen, quote, "We lived in Washington as insects lived on a tree. The direction of things was no longer so clear, but we adapted, learning, acknowledging that our faith had been uprooted. We looked up one day and discovered that we were older than the president was that winter. Yet we did not think of ourselves as young, anything but, wised up as we were, nobody knew the troubles we'd seen. It was hard to discover what faith had been uprooted during our interesting times. Faith seemed not quite the word. Perhaps the word was rectitude. Whatever it was that had been uprooted, a nervous dissatisfaction had taken its place, and in that way we were an example to the next generation. No doubt it had always been there, unspoken and hence unrecognized. Much had remained unspoken, but we were devouring the tree." Close quote. Rectitude. What an odd, old-fashioned word. Jack, with the best of liberal intentions, will make a deal with big money in Chicago to get him to the Senate, and he will explain what he means by loyalty. And we won't believe him, and neither will the ghosts of his father and the only woman he ever loved, and neither does Ward Just. And what we're left with is emptiness and irony and quiet, disquieting art.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, and as a columnist for New York Newsday, he reviewed Jack Gantz, the latest novel by Ward Just. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, political cartoonist Signe Wilkinson tells us the bigger the politician, the harder it is to offend him. Wilkinson's the editorial cartoonist for the Philadelphia Daily News. Her work is also a regular feature in Ms. Magazine. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new album of selections from Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker, the parts you don't hear every Christmas. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.